Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
You have been raised up from brutality to kill the brutals who multiply and are legion. To this end, Zardoz, your god, gave you the gift of the gun. The gun is good. We'll investigate that statement from Zardoz in the latest Resonance Rewind.
Zardoz speaks to you, his chosen ones. The gun is good.
I don't know.
It is the only path and passage into the vortex. You will show me how you come to be here. Tell me everything.
My name is Zed. For Zardoz, I am an exterminator.
Personally, any movie that has the music of Ludwig van Beethoven in can't be all bad as far as I'm concerned. But that's not the purpose of Resonance Rewind. Although we do consider music in its own way, we're here to explore that John Borman epic of the 1970s. Often misunderstood epic, often misread epic, but who knows? Let's find out what the Resonance Rewind team think of Zardoz, starting off with Ace singer-songwriter Victoria Simmons. Victoria, the first time, presumably, you've ever watched this particular narrative.
Yes, first and last.
I can see that you're not going to do a deep dive in terms of the joys of this, but okay, let's start off from the issues that you may actually have with respect to a movie which I think does actually repay repeated watchings, but you're not sure initially, is it a spoof? Is it Arthur Frayne as a kind of inspiration for the Arthur Dent character of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Sean Connery, of course, well and truly putting his days of James Bond behind him in more ways than one with this particular opening. And of course, Charlotte Rampling, a renowned actress, taking part in a whole range of things. Plus that notion that sometime in the future, maybe we have actually split up into the brutals, into the apathetics, and we need to effectively be put out of our misery. which is why, of course, we have that opening line of the gun is good.
No, well, the first problem is with you and for taking away 3 hours of my life.
But the movie's only 90 God. Minutes.
Oh, it felt like 3 hours.
Okay.
Yeah, it did feel like longer.
Well, let's talk through some of those issues you have, and let's see if we can begin to address them.
Well, it was. Now, I like the Monty Python, the Holy Grail, all those films, and it kind of felt, I think they were around the same time, so it kind of felt like it had that vibe going for it. And yet, with Monty Python, you actually laugh. And you actually find it interesting. And no, this sort of tried to do that and failed.
To be fair, I don't think this is meant to be a comedy. I think there are moments of unintentional comedy, but I think in actual, it's an attempt for a serious film projecting challenges of the 23rd, 24th century. And again, opening up the sort of areas to obviously a contemporary zone. I can see you're not convinced by that, which is fair enough.
So not at all. Absolutely not at all.
Let's turn to Jessica Burtis, obviously back in North Carolina, where she will have had, again, the first experience. Jessica, presumably you got the L. Frank Baum reveal. I did, to be fair, Jessica, give you a little caveat last week ahead of the discussion of this, when we were debating and discussing the various ways of Jason and the Argonauts, and how this is also dealing with gods and their impact on humanity and such like. So, Jessica, Victoria's been quite blunt, one might say brutal, to actually use a Zardoz term in her opening salvo. But what about yourself?
Well, I watched this today, and I still don't know how I feel. I'm just very confused. I don't know how to feel. I asked my parents if they'd heard of it. They had not. But I think even your warning last week about Sean Connery in a red nappy and this different world could not have prepared me for this at all. I think positives, I really liked the costumes. Not the loincloth, but the Eternals. I loved their 70s outfits with the little crochet sweaters and the kind of roomy pants. It was very pretty. Yes, her outfit was so pretty. The main lady, gorgeous. I would wear that outfit. Then cons. There's so much going on. But yeah, we'll start off with that positive. Love the Eternals costumes.
Okay. Costume, of course, is a speciality of our other singer-songwriter on the show today. That's Pamela Sue Mann. Pamela, you've been sending me various updates via Facebook as to obviously your progression through the movie. I'm not clear whether it's a case of you're in a WTF moment or whether you've actually had a deep psychological appreciation of Charlotte Rampling obviously portraying a divine entity, or whether it was just the stone hens that are flying through, or the stone head, I should say, that moves from vector to vector, keeping things in check, shall we say.
Well, you know, I have to say that I did not make it all the way through. I spaced out and I said, oh my God, we have a Resonance Rewind. I better find, and I found Jason and the Argonauts, and then I realized that was last week. So I scrambled to introduce myself to the world of Zardoz. And the only way I might have even known this title is our friend Gordon Ramsay creates these character names for these really amazing drawings that he does. And I believe Zardoz and what's his name, Zed. I think they may have come into play. And I'm sure that Gordon has watched this movie and probably loves it. I have to say, my mouth, I think, was open the whole time that I was watching it until I had to jump on to Resonance Rewind. And the thing is that I'm a sucker for beautiful face, and Charlotte Rampling, as soon as she came on, that's, you know, I just watched her because she's so beautiful and so cool. But honestly, I know it was the little bit of research I did on it. It was pretty much panned. It wasn't, you know, it was not a, what did it get? 1 out of 4 stars, typically. And it was very ambitious, I guess, to try and bring a personal statement of politics or the way the world is into cinema. That said, I found that I couldn't help drawing so many comparisons conceptually about our current world, in certain ways. And so I'm going to watch the rest of it after we have this session to just finish what I started. But yeah, it's, I mean, that diaper, that orange diaper, what do you call it? Lederhosen get up, with Sean Connery. I just couldn't, I couldn't put the two worlds, like, they just didn't. How much did they pay him to put that thing on? Or was he hap did he happily jump into it? I mean, there's just so many questions, Alex.
So many questions. Well, Victoria, you were delighted when I said Phil Leonis will hopefully be joining us, because I think you were particularly keen to find out what the Leonis perspective on this movie, which I believe he last saw when he was a film student himself. So it's been quite a gap since then. Phil, would you like to share your thoughts on this particular, I think, misunderstood John Boorman classic?
Well, I think maybe you're misunderstanding the word classic, but it is indeed misunderstood. I mean, and it's shockingly misunderstood when given the fact that our friend Arthur Frayne, not friend, but Arthur Frayne, says at the very beginning, he establishes what this movie is about when he asks the question, "Is God in show business too?" This is a movie about the film industry. John Boorman himself had come off genuine classics, Deliverance, Point Blank with Lee Marvin. Indeed, it was said of John Boorman, when he was great, no one was better. When he was bad, no one was worse. And both are on display in Zardoz in equally exciting fashion. But he was quite bitter about the film business when he took this up. He had spent a lot of time and coin of the realm developing his dream project, a little something called The Lord of the Rings, which Hollywood decided, are you kidding? That's not bankable. So he shifted gears to make a parable about show business and what show business was, in his estimation, bringing forth into the world, what it was creating in its audiences. The opening about the gun is good and the bringing forth of the guns. I often think myself these days, when I enjoy a movie like John Wick, I'm a huge John Wick fan. Am I actually the problem? Because I'm a person who goes through the world thinking we should be, controlling the amount of guns we have. We now have more guns in this country than we have people. In fact, I heard that celebrated in patriotic radio shows yesterday as we approach our Independence Day about how great this country is. And one of the things they held up was that we have more guns than people. That's why we're great. Let's keep going with greatness. Am I the problem? Because on the one hand, I don't like guns. On the other hand, boy, I love me my John Wick. Maybe I am the problem. Hollywood is the problem. Show business is the problem. This is why people don't like us and trust us. Because on the one hand, we tell other people how they should live. You should live without guns. On the other hand, we're making movies and we can't figure out how to tell a story without a gun resolving the problem. So there's a lot of this going on in Zardoz that John Boorman wants to express about how myth makers and storytellers and the powers that be go about entertaining and hopefully inspiring their audiences.
We've all been used and reused and abused and amused, is one of the interplay of dialogues between Friend, played by John Alderson, Arthur Frayne, of course, again, the character who I think many could have actually seen as a precursor to Arthur Dent in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or indeed the Arthurian theme, because John Boorman would go on to direct Excalibur, of course.
One thing that's fascinating that has come through everybody's comments thus far, it's important to note that the movie was not utterly panned when it came out. It was truly divided. I think most people realized that there was too much going on to dismiss it as quote unquote bad, But that's not the same as saying it worked or it pleased anyone. And what's fascinating about this film is I feel it has gotten no better and no worse. It hasn't aged in a way of like kitschy sci-fi, because at that time it wasn't campy or kitschy at all. It's fascinating. It really, I think, this feeling of, I don't know what I'm supposed to feel. I don't know what I'm supposed to think. There's so much going on. Watching it now is like watching it then, except insofar as we might shudder a little bit at what our outside world has become like during those intervening years.
So, Victoria, as somebody who wasn't around in the 1970s when this was produced, like Jessica, and again, you've already been quite brutal, as I say, not echoing the brutals of the actual characters in your dissection of the movie, are there any areas which you thought were peculiar, were unusual? Were there any areas which you kind of thought you thought, or had a moment where you thought, what's going on here?
Well, where do I start on that one? Well, I didn't quite get, they spent a lot of time talking about going from one place to another, and I didn't find that it was really very clear that there was some sort of boundary and that he'd been specially crossed through, and it took a lot of time actually for me to get that. I think it was a long time after they'd tried to explain it, and that just made no sense. The guns and horses people, if you like, they kind of reminded me of the Game of Thrones with the Dothraki, the way they looked and the way they acted. That was quite strange to me. Maybe Game of Thrones took that from the film, I don't know.
I mean, I didn't see this movie in the cinema. I saw it first time around, probably back end of the 70s, on a late night screening on BBC television. And again, I went off to sleep thinking, well, yeah, there's a certain element here which taps into a concept called new wave science fiction, a concept that the likes of Michael Moorcock would develop, that Brian Aldiss was writing about, that effectively was looking at the literal making strange. That, as Darko Suven has said, definition of science fiction is it needs to actually exhibit cognitive estrangement. You need to actually appreciate something from the point of view of its Verfremdungseffekt, its making strange. And I think it ticks quite literally all of those boxes, because it is very strange. You're not going to see, again, a kind of narrative. Yeah, you will appreciate, it's force fields that separate out various other things. There's no real indication in terms of the apathetics and how, in a sense, it's the personal saliva of Sean Connery that leads to the apathetics getting a little bit more energized, and almost a kind of a sense that they're spreading a cure to this virus of apathy that's there. Phil, you might well say the apathetics. Well, there's the Hollywood audience.
Well, there's the audience. There's the movie, and I think again, what's fun about this movie, and maybe most interesting movies, is when someone has a problem maybe understanding something, they've actually hit upon not a weakness, but maybe the point. And I would say what we say about Hollywood, right? Hollywood is not actually a place. We don't make many movies in Hollywood. Hollywood is, to be a boring cliche, a state of mind. But it is separate. Even though it is no one geographical locale, it is separate. And force fields is a wonderful way to describe how it's separate. And of course, how do you pierce that separation? Because it's one thing to say that the masses are on the outside, and that's who we're catering to, or we're feeding, or we're inspiring, or we're leading. But we are cut off from that as well in our storytelling. And there's the wonderful exchange, right, about Arthur. He ran the Outlands because no one else wanted to. He's an artist. He does it with imagination. And then the question becomes, how did we conjure up a monster in our midst? And why? And this all is about the creator losing control of the creation, and how it takes two to create meaning, right? The storyteller and the audience itself.
Jessica, most of this movie was actually shot in Ireland. You've just got back from Ireland. In terms of perspective and the things that Phil's been sharing, any other areas which, again, same question I put to Victoria, really, you kind of thought, well, that was interesting, but I don't quite know what was going on.
Yeah, I think I think now that I've gotten to listen more and kind of organize my thoughts, it's helpful to hear other perspectives on it. I think something that was interesting in it was the idea of eternal life and how they grew so apathetic with the idea of living forever, and that humanity had kind of just become stagnant, that they were happy to die and they didn't really care, and they would kind of go catatonic with how unhappy they were, and how little there was to do or to progress through. I don't think that progress necessarily equals like good and movement towards like, you know, positivity in humanity. But I do think that like when it was like this and that there was nothing to live for, that was the problem. I think that was one of the aspects I enjoyed the most. However, I think one of the aspects that kind of irritated me was, I don't know, the way that like assault was handled in it was very 70s. And I just don't think it was done very well in this movie. I didn't think that it added anything, except it was just like, oh, look how brutal they are. They assault women. It's like, okay, I think they could have handled it differently. I didn't like how it was done.
I feel like the threat of it would have been far more powerful.
Exactly, exactly. The way that they did it was not well done. So I think that kind of took me out of it for a little bit.
But is that a weakness of the movie, or is that a point that Borman's trying to make? That Hollywood always falls prey to showing you something that your imagination would do more with?
I think that could be true if it's from, yeah, that kind of idea where it's commentating on Hollywood, because that's something that continues even now within a lot of Hollywood movies.
And this is a man, after all, who knew how to stage an assault scene. He had just come off Deliverance, which has an assault scene that to this day is terrifying. So this is why it's always so interesting when you're dealing with an actual artist. No work can be taken out of context. They are all in conversation with each other. And so I find that question fascinating. I get the feeling, I don't know, we don't have Borman here, but I get the feeling that if he were to be told that this intelligent young woman 50 years from now is going to say, I have a problem with how the assaults are done because they're just not very effective. And then I feel like he would light up going, oh, well, good, there's hope for humanity then.
Hopefully,
it's a slight connection, but actually, Charlie Borman, John's son, did do a couple of shows with me back in the 1980s, and he certainly sort of was looking back then. The movie was about 20 years old then. Well, no, 15 years old, and Charlie actually always enjoyed this. He enjoyed it a lot more than Excalibur, and he said that his father sort of appreciated the line from that. But that's another line. Pamela, again, any things that percolating through your own mind in terms of the meta-narrative? I mean, I think the end sequence, certainly, of Sean Connery and Charlotte Rampling effectively growing old on the camera before our eyes and ultimately becoming skeletons and ultimately leaving just the palm print on the wall of the cave was a fascinating and very, very low-key end to the movie. I mean, this is not a movie which effectively leaves you going out into the world with a feel-good factor, but it is one which I think raises the contemplative stakes of maybe the mortality issue and how we need to cherish each moment.
Well, that's funny, the mortality issue and how we need to cherish each moment. I've been talking a lot about that, and just, you know, looking outside the window on a day like today where there's, you know, the air quality is what, almost up at 200, definitely in the 150s, which only measures to 500. And a couple of weeks ago, it goes up to 500 and we were at 484. You know, really makes you start to think about these kinds of things, you know. I definitely have to reiterate that I did not watch it all the way through, and I'm going to watch it. And I was even inspired, I don't know if this will happen, but I was inspired to write a song based on this, because actually Zardos is just, what a great title. But so much more of, you know, like what Phil was talking about, what what it's a commentary on, what it's about, and how it's very, very interesting, and it brings up question after question. So I can't really speak in an educated way to having watched the whole thing and have a lot to say about it. And if I did, anyway, it might not be that interesting, what I have to say. But I want to watch it. And I do think that it raises some very interesting questions.
Can I
don't think it's going to be...
Alex?
Yeah. Go on.
Well,
go
I just... I wanted to, just address some of the ways that I think we're having this fascinating conversation today and why this film allows for that. One thing that I was struck by was you picked Zardoz, and right now in cinemas here in America is a wonderful documentary called Lynch Oz. And it's about how Wizard of Oz runs through certainly all the works of David Lynch, sometimes quite consciously, but through every film ever since the 1950s, that it is the cinematic language that we all go back to unknowingly that has been ingrained upon us. So for us to be now talking about Zardoz, a movie that basically speaks to this, the way that cinematic myths become ingrained in us and affect the way we see things, even as artists, even when we don't know we're doing it, I think is fascinating. I also, I loved and really almost shuddered at this whole discussion about I lost my innocence. And in the moment that I lost my innocence, what became my motivating factor? Seeking the truth or revenge? Which is it? Because we are at a time right now where everybody seemingly is trying to wake up other people to what the truth really is. But what you really hear behind it so often is what they're really trying to express is just grievance. It seems like they just are seeking revenge and are cloaking it in the idea of, oh, it's me trying to wake you up. So that to me really was oddly prescient and even more relevant today. And finally, the one little sign that I saw in that scene where he talks about how he lost his innocence, there's a sign that says, "Save my soil." And I loved this idea that the pun, the wisdom of it, that our soul, our way to save it is through the soil, through rooting us in the earth and to a larger degree, our own nature, that we have to get back to what our nature is and trying to figure that out. And I think that that's a very relevant conversation today.
As I was, alluding to, Phil, the notion of the reveal and the connection with the Wizard of Oz is certainly there, and it is one of those things which, again, when I saw it, I thought, it kind of becomes fairly obvious. I mean, Victoria, when you saw that connection with Zardoz and how the title evolved and why it became the Wizard of Oz, the Wizard of Oz became Zardoz, were you surprised or did you sort of think, oh, for goodness sake, how much longer has this movie got to go?
Well, there was an element of that by at one point when I sort of started playing games on my phone, but no.
A standard cinematic audience of the 21st century.
When they said about the Wizard of Oz, yeah, it was a light bulb moment. And you're like, oh, okay, I'm starting to understand what the film is about and where some of the ties that I haven't understood yet come in. And it actually explains some of the bits that carry on after that.
And Jessica, same question. The reveal of the L. Frank Baum classic, which of course started off the 20th century and then was reinvested in to great effect by Judy Garland in 1939, a great year, brought Gone with the Wind as well as It Happened One Night to the cinematic audiences.
Yeah, I mean, both movies are very ambitious. And I think that, The Wizard of Oz is often read as a financial commentary. So it's interesting to see it with this, which is kind of a commentary on cinema, and also just I think society as it's becoming more based in technology in the 70s. So I think it's an interesting parallel, the Vortex, the Twister, May and Consuela, Wicked Witches, and that kind of thing. It's interesting to read.
Wizard of Oz is also often, read as it is about one girl coming of age, but about the process to mature femininity for girls to women. And of course, here's a movie, Zardoz, that focuses on a society that is a matriarchy. So there's that parallel as well.
And Consuela, of course, played by Charlotte Rampling, interconnects with Tabernacle, which I think was a nice, interesting line, and certainly taps into the Judeo-Christian notion of the tabernacle, the holder, the home, the house, in a sense, almost the cover, the ark of the covenant, really, from that perspective. And a lovely line from Tabernacle: "Sleep was necessary for man when his waking and unconscious lives were separated. As Eternals achieved total consciousness, sleep became obsolete and second-level meditation took its place. Sleep was closely connected with death." Let's talk characters. Victoria, any of the characters that you encountered inspire you, as Pamela possibly is, to write a song about or a sort of number for yourself?
Possibly the people when they'd grown old or forced to be old. They were kind of interesting, because was it just the outside? Some of it was the inside as well. And it was almost at the end, they were in a coma because they'd got old and had no memories. And that they were interesting to me.
Interesting, of course, in terms of the forced aging that comes across within that side of things. Jessica, what about last number? Was there a character that came out of that, Victoria?
One single character.
Yeah.
Is it the creator at the beginning of the whole thing, that is the man lying in bed? I think he's the scientist that first started it all, and it's sort of, he's the start and the end of it.
Okay, yep. And Jessica, again, I think it was Bray, County Wicklow Island, where the vortex was basically put into place. Any honourable mentions or particular characters which stood out for yourself?
So I think for me, Consuela was my favourite character. I think she was so interesting, her mindset and how she talked with May, and how she viewed this newcomer. I think she had such an analytical mind. It was very interesting to watch her think. And also, her costume was fabulous. Her hair, amazing. I just want her whole outfit. I don't like the ending for Consuela, though. But I do have to admit that the skeleton's holding... I won't spoil it for Miss Pamela, never mind. I take it back. But yeah, I do think the line... I'm not sure if she said it or not, but it was someone else where they were watching the Brutals get... killed, and she was saying, oh, we can't ascribe, you know, their feelings like us, you know, they're just there for entertainment. And I thought that was very interesting, you know, part of the commentary. But yeah, Consuela.
I think an interesting 2009 review, which is online, which has the headline "Incredibly Profound Allegory Disguised as a Cheesy Movie," is interesting. Anytime a film begins with a giant five-story stone head saying the gun is good, the penis is evil, you know you're in for a wild ride. Oh, I also forgot that horribly silly prologue spoken by some dude with a magic marker mustache and an equally contrived pseudo-Elizabethan accent, which is really what makes most people throw in the towel after 5 minutes. But if you can get past all that, it gets a lot better. Pamela, favourite character?
No, that part, actually, Alex, that part made me wish that I could shrink time or expand time. Well, in whichever order, because I thought, this is going to be great. Really, honestly. So as soon as we get off this session, I am going to hop back over to my TV and I'm going to watch the rest of it. And I'm going to send Alex some more gratuitous, annoying, pesky.
It's what I appreciate from you, Pamela. You know, it's what the web is for.
Well, you know, I'm going to go with Consuela, and I'm probably gonna, my instincts are usually right. Not always, but usually. So I have a feeling that I'm gonna be glad that I chose her in the future. And I'm going with her as my favorite.
I think I'll give an honorable mention for John Alderton as Friend, who I think managed to actually work very well in terms of the incarnation. But Phil, over to you.
Yeah, he's wonderful. That actor, especially, what a wonderful job he does, and in that strange world, getting such a good arc as an actor. But I'm going to tell you, my favorite characters that I spent time with in this movie were Christopher Reeve's Superman, Harrison Ford's Indiana Jones, Roy Batty, Rutger Hauer from Blade Runner, because these people were all greatly influenced by this film. There are moments where you're sitting there going, oh my goodness, the influence this had on the Fortress of Solitude, on the way of learning through the crystal, the sense we're learning out of time. This all gets used in Richard Donner's Superman. The crystal and the way it parts things, like the crystal skull in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. There are other references that Spielberg takes. It's all very exciting. It all made me feel really young again, like, oh man, anything is possible. Go watch this film from the past, go to this, what is the phrase? Go to a room in the past so that you may find the future. In this secret room from the past, I seek the future. There's that sign in the movie. And that's what we do. We go to these movies that are from the past and we see how they can influence our future. And he did this, a Blade Runner, there's references. I first started to think, well, maybe I'm just hearing things when Sean Connery says, you know, I've seen things. And then we hear that echoed in Roy Batty's speech. But then he's wandering through a hall of wax figures, of Napoleonic wax figures, which is used in Blade Runner. So that's all very exciting. And I feel myself getting younger and younger again with the enthusiasm of falling in love with movies. But then it's almost as Borman does not know how to end it after the Tsar Dawes, Wizard of Oz experience. And so what does he do? He starts going back to the movies he liked when he was young and starts evoking Orson Welles' Lady from Shanghai, the whole Hall of Mirrors climax. And man, I feel like I age 5 years during that climactic sequence. Because I've seen it before and I've seen it better, and he's just reaching for his influences at that point.
And again, characters, I think we sort of say, so the let's say the archetypes, let's go numbers. Victoria Simmons, let's go to you first. I'm not sure whether this has kind of either improved your score, whether it's allowed you to think, well, maybe I need to give another reflection through the crystal on this particular aspect. But what's your score?
Yeah, I have two scores. Obviously, I have the score when I watched it, which is 2. And I'm not going to watch it again, but I think everybody needs a fill-in-ness commentary throughout the whole thing, and then I'd notch it up to a 4.
Interesting. I mean, I certainly, it's moved from me from initially a 3 or a 4 up to an 8 as the years have gone by. Possibly might be going slightly higher, but maybe that's just become a more chronologically gifted. Jessica?
I would have said a 5, because I don't think this movie is like trying to, I feel like it knows exactly what it is. I don't think it's trying to be something else. And I think that's very important in movies like this. But I've brought my score up to a 6 because, like Victoria, hearing the Phil Learness thoughts has been very interesting. And having the perspective of someone who understands that has helped me. So I think it's a 6, a very solid 6. And the sets were nice.
Pamela, do you want to hold your score or give an initial score from the few moments you've seen so far?
I will give an initial score, and it sways to the good and sways to the bad being Sean Connery's diaper, and the good being, you know, the fabulously penciled Shakespearean face, and Charlotte Rampling, of course, and all of the other things that Phil was speaking of. So I think I'm going to preemptively give it, because I'm a high scorer too, I'm going to preemptively give it a 6.5, and then we'll see where it lands. I will text you. It might be after the fact. That's okay. But I'll text you, Alex, and let you know what my end score is.
And Phil?
I agree with Jessica. This movie knows exactly what it is. It is what the filmmaker intended, which I love, because then it's like, well, conversations about good and bad. I mean, seem less important at that point. More nourishing conversations like the one we've had are the result of it. At the same time, he's the fortunate beneficiary of some good luck when it comes to casting. Charlotte Rampling, who everybody has hailed, the thing that I love is this is maybe the first time that just world-class beauty, Charlotte Rampling, is able to show how much she can project violence while silent, even. And in some of her best performances, wow, she is a force of nature without having to do anything. And so I love that. Sean Connery in a diaper. Let's just say, isn't it better than Burt Reynolds in a diaper, who is who it was supposed to be?
Yes.
Connery steps in at the very last minute when Burt Reynolds gets sick. And God bless Sean Connery. I think it's a better performance also because Connery, by his own admission, never understood science fiction. He said he just doesn't understand it. So he turned down science fiction projects that, as he admits, were probably better, said yes to ones that maybe weren't as good. But he said, like, I just don't get it. And I feel like that helps the performance that he has in playing this guy, trying to figure everything out. I would have probably given it, when I first saw it as a kid, a 6, maybe in film school when I was becoming a little more jaded, a 5. I'm back to a 6. And I don't want to give it more than that, because although I feel like this conversation, and if we were able to go on for another hour, more conversations about it, I would give the conversation a 10. But I want to champion the idea of movies that are 6s, because sometimes it's this range of film that does lead to the most nourishing discussions, rather than works that we can all avow as masterpieces or we can always reject as being bombs.
Victoria Simmons, Jessica Burtis, Phil Leonis, and Pamela Suman, huge thanks indeed. Next week, we're back in somewhat safer territory as we go in to see an episode of Star Trek entitled The Paradise Syndrome, which also has a number of other key aspects to look at and maybe speak to from our current state of play. But now, as ever, keep on resonating.
Thank you.